You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 8 of a series in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 11, verse 1. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, these are the living things that you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the animals, you may eat. Nevertheless, among those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these. The camel, because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the rock badger, because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the hare, because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the pig, because it parts the hoof and is cloven-footed but does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall not touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. These you may eat of all that are in the waters, everything in the waters that has fins and scales, whether in the seas or in the rivers, you may eat. But anything in the seas or the rivers that has not fins and scales, of the swarming creatures in the waters and of the living creatures that are in the waters, it is detestable to you. You shall regard them as detestable. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall detest their carcasses. Everything in the waters that has not fins and scales is detestable to you. And these you shall detest among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are detestable. The eagle, the bearded vulture, the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind, every raven of any kind, the ostrich, the nighthawk, the seagull, the hawk of any kind, the little owl, the cormorant, the short-eared owl, the barn owl, the tawny owl, the carrion vulture, the stork, the heron of any kind, the hoopoe, and the bat. All winged insects that go on all fours are detestable to you. Yet among the winged insects that go on all fours, you may eat those that have jointed legs above their feet, with which to hop on the ground. Of them you may eat the locust of any kind, the bald locust of any kind, the cricket of any kind, and the grasshopper of any kind. But all other winged insects that have 4 feet are detestable to you. And by these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever carries any part of their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. Every animal that parts the hoof but is not cloven-footed or does not chew the cud is unclean to you. Everyone who touches them shall be unclean. And all that walk on their paws among the animals that go on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and he who carries their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. They are unclean to you. And these are unclean to you among the swarming things that swarm on the ground: the mole rat, the mouse, the great lizard of any kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the sand lizard, and the chameleon. These are unclean to you among all that swarm. Whoever touches them when they are dead shall be unclean until the evening. And anything on which any of them falls when they are dead shall be unclean. Whether it is an article of wood or a garment or a skin or a sack, any article that is used for any purpose, it must be put into water, and it shall be unclean until the evening, then it shall be clean. And if any of them falls into any earthenware vessel, all that is in it shall be unclean. And you shall break it. Any food in it that could be eaten, on which water comes, shall be unclean. And all drink that could be drunk from every such vessel shall be unclean. And everything on which any part of their carcass falls shall be unclean. Whether oven or stove, it shall be broken in pieces. They are unclean and shall remain unclean for you. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern holding water shall be clean, but whoever touches a carcass in them shall be unclean. And if any part of their carcass falls upon any seed that is to be sown, it is clean. But if water is put on the seed and any part of their carcass falls on it, it is unclean to you. And if any animal which you may eat dies, whoever touches its carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever eats of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. And whoever carries the carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. Every swarming thing that swarms on the ground is detestable. It shall not be eaten. Whatever goes on its belly and whatever goes on all fours, or whatever has many feet, any swarming thing that swarms on the ground, you shall not eat, for they are detestable. You shall not make yourselves detestable with any swarming thing that swarms, and you shall not defile yourselves with them and become unclean through them. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground, for I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law about beasts and bird and every living creature that moves through the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the living creature that may be eaten and the living creature that may not be eaten. Now, this is the first of five chapters that deal with questions of purity, clean and unclean. This chapter, of course, focusing on the foods that can and can't be eaten by the Israelites. And I'm sure as I read through the chapter, it sounds very foreign to you. That's probably going to become a stronger feeling when we get into the next few chapters, because this is not our way of thinking and our way of living. It's something that it's not practiced any longer by Christians. It doesn't apply to us. The New Testament makes that clear. The Lord Jesus spoke in a way that made it clear. At least it was the understanding of his followers that he was pronouncing foods to be clean. Although he himself would have kept these food laws, he was indicating that with the change in relationship with God that was coming through him, the food laws would no longer apply. And when it comes to the book of Acts, that's clearly taught to the Apostle Peter when he sees a sheet being lowered down from heaven three times. It's a symbol of the journey that he's to make to the house of Cornelius in order to share the gospel with Cornelius and be involved in seeing Cornelius and other Gentile God-fearers receiving the Holy Spirit. But it was also a direct command that was given to say that everything in this sheet was clean and could be eaten. So it was a direct overturning or indication rather that these laws, not that they're overturned as such, but that they were given only for a specific period of time and to the nation of Israel. So quite rightly, we as Christians today are not bound by them. We don't keep these laws. But not only do they sound foreign to us, they also sound a bit pointless and meaningless. Why is it that there are certain animals that are not to be eaten? What is it that God is teaching his people through this? So we need to take a moment to try and think, why is it that these chapters are in the Bible? Chapters that have been described, and I'm quoting from a quote within Derek Tidbell's commentary on Leviticus. He quotes another commentator, N. Micklem, who again was quoted by another commentator. So it's a quote within a quote within a quote. But that commentator described these as perhaps the least attractive chapters in the whole Bible, with much in them that seems to the modern reader to be meaningless or repulsive. Least attractive, meaningless, and repulsive. So welcome to Leviticus 11 to 15. Now, I remember when I was a younger person, a teenager, and growing up as a Christian and being taught, I can't remember where I heard it from, but I certainly remember hearing the idea that the food laws that God gave might have been to do with hygiene. In other words, God was keeping them safe from diseases that could be carried by some of the animals, pigs, for example, being close to humans in terms of their genes and their anatomy and so on, are prone to some of the same diseases. And so pork might have been unclean, literally unclean, in the sense that it was likely to carry infections. But as you read through the list, and I'm no expert in zoology, I don't know all of the species that are named here. In fact, some of the Hebrew names are open to debate as to exactly which species or type of animal they're referring to. Although most of them are really quite clear, and the categories are very clear indeed. And they would have been clear to the people who first received these laws, of course. But the point is that I'm led to believe that there's no correlation, really, when you read through the chapter. There's no evidence that the unclean animals are actually more likely to carry diseases than the clean ones. It's certainly not uniformly true. And I remember when I was teaching full-time in a Bible college, in a course on world religions, and we had the local Orthodox rabbi in for my students to hear from him about modern Judaism, Orthodox Judaism. And one of the students asked him about the food laws, and specifically were these laws to do with hygiene? And he said that he had heard of this, he'd come across that theory from some Christians, but as far as he was concerned, there was only one reason that he should keep the law, and it was because God commanded it. He didn't need to have a reason to justify it. He was content to say that there were things he didn't understand, but he obeyed them because God said them. I thought that was a great response. I found it very challenging, and still do personally, to say, why is it that I want to have reasons for everything? I feel like God ought to explain everything to me rather than being content simply to obey. I suppose, as an Orthodox Jew, my friend was not influenced by the Enlightenment, which put such emphasis on human rationality and the need for a reason to justify everything. Orthodox Judaism deliberately rejected the Enlightenment when other branches of Judaism followed it. But of course, those of us who live in the West have been profoundly influenced by the Enlightenment. And please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it is a bad thing to seek understanding. I'm not saying that we should all remain ignorant and in the dark. But what I am saying is that there are things that can be understood. There are times when God gives reasons, and there are other times when he doesn't. And when we live with the mystery of his actions, trusting that he has a good reason, but that we might never know it, at least in this life. And so my rabbi friend was prepared to say, well, if God commanded it, I will do it. Indeed, the whole of these chapters that talk about cleanliness and uncleanness, whatever the details might mean and why ever they might be given, actually the key message that is here, the central message of Leviticus as a whole, is that God is holy. And the holiness of God and our worship of God impacts every dimension of life, including what we eat. There's no aspect of life, there is no part of creation that is not under his lordship. And the holiness of God is something that is visibly and demonstrated in the book of Leviticus in the instructions that God gives. Now, of course, as we enter into these chapters, we need to remember, first of all, that cleanness is not the same as holiness, and uncleanness is not the same as morally impure. If something is unclean, it means that it is not fit for service of God, for use in the ritual worship of God that was given to Israel. And if it's going to be used in those ways and offered to God, then it has to be made clean. So we shouldn't think that anything that is described as unclean in these chapters, including the animals in this chapter, is actually morally wrong or impure or condemned by God. These laws are about the proper place for things, the right condition of things, for things to be in order for them to be part of the worship of God from Israel. As we'll see in chapters 12 to 15, many things that become unclean or are unclean for a reason can be purified. They can be made clean. We get a little bit of that in this chapter, not with the animals themselves, but with things that have been in contact with unclean animals. But the animals cannot be made clean. They are permanently unclean, unsuitable to be eaten. There's no way they can be cleansed. And so looking at the detail of the instructions that are here, there are different categories of animals. It sounds like a biology textbook, doesn't it? A kind of categorization of animal types. There are the land animals in verses 2 to 8, the sea creatures in verses 9 to 12, the birds in verses 13 to 19, and the insects in verses 20 to 23. When it comes to the land animals, the key question is whether the animal has a split hoof and chews the cud. Any animal with a split hoof that is completely divided and chews the cud is clean and can be eaten. If it has neither of those or only one of those qualities, then it is unclean ceremonially, cannot be eaten. Again, it's not a prohibition on touching these animals. Or on making use of them. Of course, camels were unclean. They chew the cud and they have a split hoof, but the hoof is not completely divided, so they're in the unclean list. But camels could be ridden. Dogs are unclean, but dogs could, well, people in the Middle East don't tend to keep dogs as pets, but they can certainly be hit or beaten or used as guard dogs and so on. But when they are dead, their carcasses are also unclean. So they cannot be eaten. And when they're dead, they can't be touched. And so you can't use their skin or bones for any purpose. You can't make things from their dead animals. Now, again, that tells us that the animals become detestable to the Israelites. That's the phrase that's used. But we shouldn't take that to mean that the animals themselves are bad or are not precious to God. In fact, these animals have protection because they're not going to be eaten by people who we know are quite capable of hunting animals even to extinction. And some commentators have suggested that that's the reason for these commands, that it's to preserve these species on earth. Others have even said it's to reduce Israel's consumption of meat. But again, that's a bit speculative. And again, these are not commands that fit with the culture of the nations around Israel, because we know that other nations in the ancient Near East ate some of these animals. They ate pigs, they ate camels. So Israel is not just following a sort of cultural norm. In fact, again, some commentators suggest that it may be to set Israel apart from the other nations, which God is certainly concerned to do, that he gives them these prohibitions. Perhaps these animals or some of them were used in the worship of false gods amongst the nations surrounding Israel, but certainly it would have made Israel distinct. It would have made it difficult for Israel to engage in trade for food with the other nations around them because of the unclean carcasses that would have been in those places, or even to eat with their neighbours from other religions. So we know, for example, that the pig was important within the worship or the worship rituals around death in Egypt and also in Canaan. And so again, this sets Israel apart from their false ways of worship. The clean animals, again, it's been suggested, are the domesticated animals. Certainly they are the animals that human beings can control and domesticate. And that may have a resonance with Genesis, that these are the animals that that humankind is able to continue to have dominion over, unlike the wild animals that they can't tame. Although, of course, dogs can be domesticated, but they're unclean animals. But certainly it means that there is an order in this. The animals that are domesticated and kept in farms are also the ones that can be eaten and can be used in the sacrificial system. And so it's setting that domestic life of Israel apart from the wild, the parts of creation that are not under human control, that are impacted in that way by the result of sin and the fall, the curse that God put on creation. And when it comes to the sea creatures in verses 9 to 12, the basic question there is whether they have fins or scales. If they do, they're clean. If they don't, they're unclean. And that means that things like prawns and eels and octopuses would not be allowed or permitted. Some people have speculated on why those instructions are there. But again, I don't think we can know with any certainty. When it comes to the birds in verses 13 to 19, there isn't a general requirement in the way that there is for the animals and for the sea creatures. And so instead, specific kinds of birds that are unclean are listed. There's no list of clean birds. So rather than it being a standard by which you recognize the clean birds, it's a list of the birds that are not clean. And they're mainly birds of prey that eat the dead bodies of other animals. And so because they've been in contact with unclean animals' carcasses, of course, that makes them unclean, or animals that drink blood, which of course would have made them unclean as well, or birds rather that drink blood. And then lastly, we have the insects from verse 20 onwards. And almost all of these are unclean, with just a few exceptions in the locusts and crickets and grasshoppers. And then we have the instructions about what's to be done to make clean those things that come in contact with the carcasses of unclean animals, which carries down to verse 43. And again, the re-emphasis in verse 41 to 43 about swarming things on the ground. But look at verse 44 and 45. Here's the crux of the matter. The reason that they are to be obedient to God is because he is the Lord their God who brought them out of Egypt, and they are to be holy as he is holy. God calls them into relationship with himself. Their Redeemer, who rescued them from Egypt, calls them to become like him. And although the reasons may not be given why obedience to these food laws reflect that holiness of God, holiness and orderliness, yet it's part of their response of obedience to him. This is the heart of the law. Come and know me, be with me through sacrifice, and be like me through obedience to the laws that I have given. It's still the call of God to us, isn't it? To his redeemed through Christ and through his blood shed for us. Come, be holy. Or as Jesus put it in the Sermon on the Mount, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Obedience and holiness for us as God's people is always a response to these two great truths, the character of God and the grace of God in saving us. We respond to him because he is holy, and we respond to him because he is our Redeemer and our Saviour. And so without speculating too much about the reasons for the laws, and I've mentioned some of the possible interpretations that have been given as we've talked through this chapter. But it does seem that when it comes to their representation of holiness and being holy like God, there is something about order that is at play here. the rules that they are given are following a pattern of their social ordering, the way their lives are ordered, the rituals that they are to be involved in worship, and a sense of normality and abnormality of what is the normal condition of things. So the normal fields of the, or beasts of the field, have split hooves and chew the cud. The ones that don't are a departure from that. The normal creatures in the sea have scales and fins, and the ones that don't are departures from that. Again, not saying that God got it wrong when he created those or that he didn't create them, but actually saying that orderliness is a reflection of God's character, and that's certainly a biblical theme. And so Israel is to be an ordered society socially and in relationship and in terms of their diet, and it's to reflect the norms of God's creation, the kinds that are normative and that are mainstream, if you like. Israel is to be an ordered society that brings its worship to God on that basis of orderliness. So as they thought about which animals they could eat and which ones they couldn't, they would be reminded again of God's oneness, of his wholeness and his holiness, his completeness, his purity, his singleness, that there is no deviation, no abnormality, no alternative, and that only things that are orderly like God are worthy to be part of their life, of their diet. Constant reminder of the holiness, the oneness, and the purity of God. And so as we close this look at the food laws that were given to Israel, that's the question for us, isn't it? Are we living lives that are orderly, completely ordered around this one principle, the character of God and the grace of God to us? We might say, well, we don't have food laws, and no, we don't. But the food that we eat should be influenced, shouldn't it, by our worship of God. We ought to be concerned about where the food comes from, about how those who grow it or farm it are paid, and whether our cheap food is actually driving them into poverty. We should be concerned about fair trade for things that can be fairly, to make sure everything is fairly traded and that people get a wage that allows them to live. We should be concerned too about the impact on the environment. The amount of meat that we eat is destructive to the environment. So it's not to say we should become vegan or vegetarian, but we should reduce our meat consumption. We should try and eat meat that is local, even if it's a bit more expensive, so that we're not putting lots of carbon into the atmosphere, transporting it. And we should think about whether our dietary habits actually reflect ungodly impulses. Are we eating too much or eating too little? Are we thankful for our food to God as its source, rather than thinking it's the supermarkets that we should thank? And then we should think too about whether there are certain foods that are so associated with ungodly behaviors that we should abstain from them. The obvious one, of course, is alcohol. And scripture does not command us to abstain from alcohol. But in some cultures and contexts, perhaps we should avoid drinking it because of the connotations that it has, because of the misuses of it amongst other people. And we should be concerned about the healthy balance of food, shouldn't we? Making sure that the food that we eat is a healthy balance. All food is good, but too much of any food is bad, isn't it? And so our call to holiness should begin with the question, not what am I restricted from, but how can I maximize the glory of God? How can I express holiness? How can I honor and please God in this? And how can I respond to the grace of God and help others to see him in the choices that I make around my diet? Let's maximize our pursuit of God's glory not in a judgmental way that condemns others as if we are legalists, but actually in a joyful way of thanksgiving and obedience to our Father.